Blog Talk Radio.
Because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You're now tuned into the higher inner frequency of Soul Class 491 in search of ancient authentic Torah, program presentation 121, and of course we are configured with blogtalkradio.com. Blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. It's now 9:32 here live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. Today's program content will focus on the Book of Genesis, Chapter 6, Verse 19, the Book of Proverbs, Chapter 3, Verse 19, teachings from Rambam, Reza/Chabad Chassidus, a discussion concerning the seven universal commandments and whatever can transpire when human beings access their divine image. Our call in number is, in fact, at this most existential of moments, 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones in a peaceful and pleasant manner. You're listening to The Generation of Redemption from Isaac Baton's Generation Redemption album. But in order to get into the show, we've got to lower the music and, in fact, cue it out. Oh, sorry, Rabbi Isaac, president of the Beit Mazel congregation here, 1433 Keswick Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and also avid participant in the prayers of the famous Frankel Shul as well here in Keswick Crown Heights. Joining me this morning is Rambam's teacher, student, and the seminar of the teachings of the Nesher HaGadol, the Great Eagle, Rambam Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon. Dennis Ryan, good morning, sir, to you.
Boker Tov, Don. Beautiful day.
Yes, it is. And it's even more beautiful when human beings get together to talk about things which are of importance not only to soul, but also as well as body. That will segue us right into the beginning of today's presentation. Blessed souls. Starting with a letter from the Lubavitch Rebbe, Schussi Yogan Aleinu, may his merits protect us. This was a letter that the Rebbe had written 40-plus years ago. It was written the day before the giving of the commemoration of the giving of the Torah, which is known as Shavuot or Matan Torah, which the world identifies as the day that the Ten Commandments were given to Moses and the Israelites. And of course, those are 10 general categories as well being 10 specific commandments, but and when we get to that portion in Porshas Yisro, we'll go more into those details. So this letter is titled, Physical Health Facilitates Spiritual Health. And the letter, which is only three paragraphs. I'll read it in its entirety. And, of course, we'll turn to Dennis for feedback. And, of course, if you want to call in and participate in this jam without the jelly, 347-838-8669. So here comes the letter coming down the verbal pipeline. I trust that this letter finds you in good health and in good spirits. Something that is also relevant to the holiday of Shavuos, when God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, the Israelite people, Hebrew, Israelite, Jewish people, whatever way you want to call us. For as our sages of blessed memory tell us, before God gave the Torah to the Jewish people at Sinai, all those who were in ill health were cured and revitalized. This aspect of achieving good physical health prior to receiving the Torah is also eminently logical, since a physically healthy Jew can better comprehend and follow the Torah and mitzvahs, therefore accomplishing all that he/she is required to accomplish. It thus follows that a Jew is duty bound to take care of his health or her health, since the health of the divine soul depends largely on the health of the body, as both a healthy soul and a healthy body are essential in order to achieve the maximum requirements and expectations of the Jew. Now, I just want to universalize this teaching, blessed souls, because while this was specifically a letter to encourage the Jewish people 40 plus years ago now, it is also instructions for all human beings, because the Torah was not given in a way that only one people should be healthy and one people should be spiritually actualized. But if we, as the nation of Israel, can exemplify this ideal of good health and good spirits, hopefully it will strike a match within the consciousness of other human beings, and the wick of their life, which is basically connected to their life expectancy, connected with the oil or the wax, which is connected to the maintenance of their lives, will be burning with a sense of purpose, of proper stewardship upon the face of this blessed earth. Dennis?
The human body comes in two parts, the physical part and the mental part. They come together and they work together. However, under normal conditions, you would expect somebody to take care of their body. Some people even call it a temple from God. Each body is a carbon-based rental that has to be returned at some point in time. We do not have it forever. Your mind can be independent of your body, but it depends on the health of the body to keep the mind going. So your mind is not independent. It relies on the rest of the body to keep going. So one cannot talk about one independent of the other. However, there are people who have physical infirmities that do not allow them to have a normal body per se, but that doesn't right. Their mind from going on and on. So yes, what happens is we have to be aware, just like the rabbi said there, we have to be aware that we have a body and a mind. And if you purposely ignore one or the other, then you are not following a normal path. And that's of your choosing. So why stray from the normal when you can be healthy and mentally sound?
True. Thank you, Dennis. And I just want to mention that one of those who revitalized and healed before the giving of the Torah, now it's 3,327 plus years ago, was in fact the lawgiver himself, the one who was the human loudspeaker for the Creator. That was Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, who in fact at the age of 3 had been burned by a coal and had a speech impediment causing him to stutter. So this was something which was part of the makeup and life experiences of Moshe. Then basically, from the age of 3 to the age of 80, 77 years, he had an infirmity. But even before he received the Torah, he was just at the beginning of his journey as the leader of Israel. So this is also something that we can take heart for those who have some sort of infirmity or weakness, which I guess would be seen by others, and most importantly, that if they perceive that weakness physically within themselves, they'll hopefully get involved in some sort of program, but of course the assistance of loved ones and health practitioners, and if need be, mental health practitioners, wellness or fitness coaches, to realize when you make that decision to strengthen yourself, you are in fact, as mundane as it might seem, as and you know, you're not necessarily going to get coverage on CNN or CBS News or written up in the New York Times. The moment that you try to strengthen your health, you are exemplifying a Torah-mandated type of lifestyle. Of course, you can only do what you can do. You know, we none of us are expected. I'm at 53, and Dennis is in his early 70s. May the Most High continue to bless and protect you, Dennis. No one's expecting, say, Don Goodman to reach the strength of, say, like a 22-year-old. I'm not doing that. I'm at a stage of trying to maintain what I have so I can, so to speak, slow down the process of aging. So when I get to the next level of life, whether it be 54, 58, 62, 71, or beyond those years and up to 120, that I've participated in my aging in a way that's proactive, not just reacting to my infirmities. Dennis?
Well, that's true, Don, because some people say you're as old as you feel, but that's a human way of looking at it. We have to look at it on a larger scale, and that is your mind can be just as active as you were in your teens as you're in your older age. But did you gain any knowledge, common sense, wisdom? Because that's what we're put on the earth for, to accumulate better knowledge of the Almighty. And if you haven't done that, then you are sort of wasting away and waiting. Waiting for what? Waiting for the end without contacting or communicating with God. This is an ongoing thing, and we must be forever active as long as we have a spark in our bodies and our minds.
True. Thank you, Dennis. And with that being said, we're now going to move on to the next session of our presentation. Chapter 6, verse 19 from the book of Genesis. We're still in the context of the story of Noah and his three sons and their three wives and, of course, his wife, making the preparations before that epic event would transpire as it did over 4,000 years ago, that is the flood, during the lifetime of Noah and his descendants, of whom we are part of those descendants. So chapter 6, verse 19, the Most High told Noah, "From all life, from all flesh, two of each bring into the ark to live with you. They shall be male and female." So in the oral Torah explanations, we see very terse but very potent instruction, and then we're going to sync that up to a brief teaching from the inner dimensions of Torah, from a teaching from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. First, we see not from Rashi, but from other sources in the oral Torah, that God told Noah that these animals were not merely to survive, but to quote-unquote live. He should take as good care of them as he does of himself. And Rashi embellished the point that was just two of each. Even of the least numerous of the species of animals, there were no less than two, one male and one female. With that being said, blessed souls, metaphorically speaking, again drawing from a teaching from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, this teaches us that it is our duty as human beings to bring anyone and everyone in danger of spiritually drowning into the shelter of our own spiritual ark. The doctrine of divine providence, also known as Hashkacha Pratit or Hashkacha Pratis, implies that when God arranges for us to find out that someone needs help, it is because we are meant to draw him or her into our lives and bring him or her closer to godliness. Dennis?
Yes, there's a magnet between all humans. It's a slight magnet, but you got to feel the pull. And the pull is that we were designed to work with other humans. And that means that we have a connection. Not only do we were given the same form, we were also given the same mind. And that we developed the same values. So therefore, we have a lot in common. So that commonality, even though some people who don't like this idea of commonality, but it's there, it's born, it's inherent in our being. And that says that you will have a relationship with other people. So it depends on how you want to go about it. Will you accept him with open arms, or will you have guarded suspicion? But either way, there's a pull towards another human. And when you see somebody who needs help, there's something in your heart, your mind, and your body that says, gee, that person needs help. And some people do it without even thinking. They don't say, I'm going to help people today. But if they see someone who needs help, they help them. So this goes on and on. If more people practice this commonality and the help that's required, it would be a better world. But we do have some people that say, no, I don't know them, so that's none of my business. Baloney. It is your business. You may not think you're your brother's keeper, but certainly you're part of the human race, and you must participate.
Beautiful, Dennis. That being said, we're going to now move on to the next section of today's presentation, going to the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, verse 19, with a little bit of elucidation from Rashi, and what I would call for myself a little bit of Torah Savor, reasoning within the context of Torah. So chapter 3, verse 19 from Proverbs, also known as Mishlei, reads as follows. The Lord founded the earth with wisdom, established the heavens with discernment. So Rashi elucidates, concerning the portion of this verse, the Lord founded the earth with wisdom, Rashi explains, according to the Torah. This is the Torah which is discernment and which is knowledge. So Bresetel, here we see that, yes, you can scientifically explore what is this compounded substance called earth with all the waters that are in the, which are observable and which are which you can tap into the wellsprings and the wells and even go deep into the abyss as far as you can, as humanly possible in the ocean waters, or to drill into the abyss of the earth. However, beyond that, according to King Solomon with prophetic wisdom, that the wisdom that we're talking about, that is the fundamental catalyst for this planet Earth, is Torah, which we also describe as divine instruction. Meaning, it's not just, and there's nothing that invalidates what I'm going to say, there's nothing, you know, that the Earth is made of the various minerals and substances and affected by air and water and fire, but who created that earth, wind and fire and water? Who created that? Who created the principles of water? Who created the principles of fire? Who created the principles of wind or ruach, of spirit? And therefore, if there is that we can understand and accept, I readily accept it, I'm sure Dennis does as well, that there is a divine principle underlining and is the true foundation of this physical earth, this blessed physical earth that we live upon, certainly too, there is a certain discernment aside from the wisdom that can spring out of this knowledge that the earth is according toward divine design. And there's a knowledge about this earth which we can access through the teachings of divine instruction, which again we have Israel called Torah, I'm sure people call it other things. And by the way, again, that is not a contradiction to looking into all the nooks and crannies of all the compounded substances which constitute this physical earth. Dennis?
Yes, I look at it a slightly different way, Don. And what happens is when we are born, we enter into what God has given us. And it's like a buffet, a feast, so to speak. And we have to participate in it because it's there. We didn't make it. He gave it to us. But he gave it to us to be used by us for the best purposes. And that's a choice that everybody makes. But I've had a lot of Jewish and non-Jewish friends of mine saying, I don't understand all this. I just can't comprehend. I can't put it all together. I don't know what they're talking about. It's beyond me. Well, to me, I hear that, and the bell goes off, and it sounds like a bunch of excuses. And I have to explain to these people, do you have faith and belief? And normally they all say yes. So I said, then why don't you think it's working? And they usually say, well, God hasn't given me enough. I don't understand. I said, wait a minute. Whoever said this was a one-way street? It's a two-way street. You must use what God has given you, so that way you make it a two-way street. You're a participant in what is going on of the plan and the design that the Almighty put together. I said, of course you're not going to know all the details, but you already have the faith and the belief. So why don't you continue? Because, let's put it this way, are you trying as hard as you could? Have you accomplished as much as you think you should have? Or have you fallen back, slowed down, and said, well, I've done enough, I want God to do the rest? And I tell them it doesn't work that way. You are being lazy, and you're not using all the properties and all those things, gifts, fruits that God has given you to use. So you must try a little bit harder. To say you're giving up is a complete waste of time. And since you believe and you have faith, you're not going to commit suicide. So that means you're going to be here for the duration of your life. Do something with it. Make something of yourself. And keep the faith and belief going so you do away with all doubts.
Beautiful, Dennis. And I just want to mention that I think that when there's a intellectual blockage between those people you mentioned and accessing teachings which would help clarify for them how do we connect the dots between physicality, spirituality, which is also just a string of divinity in relation to this creator who cannot really be pinned down as to how many strings creator consists of, because creator is beyond being a compounded and even beyond even a simplistic, meaning uncompounded entity. He is the source of all. And I think there's a lot of emotional blockage, emotional fear, because these teachings are basically compelling people to reconsider their previous perceptions of their lives, their family's lives, society, the here, now, and forever, and realize, wait a minute, I'm 20, 30, 70, 80 years old, and I don't know too much. What am I going to do? I've made the grade. I have had a successful career. I have a successful career. I have a nice wife. I have a nice children. I see my children doing well. But yet still, when you tell me that there's something I haven't been told my whole life, I think that causes a lot of people to cringe, Dennis. And all we can do is say is that, well, listen, it's really relative. You know, we talked about this commonality. Because you can even cite Rambam, who says, even after a person has learned everything which is contained in the oral and written Torah, he or she must come ultimately to a higher level of consciousness to realize, I really know nothing at all, and re-engage in it to because as much as we can know, there's always something we don't know. As long as it's something we don't know, we're still in the category of those who are learning how to know, or the knowers. And in fact, there was a recapitulation of a teaching of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which to this day I hope I will never forget. And it goes like this: show me a person who knows everything, and the evidence of that person knowing everything is he'll be able to explain everything he knows to any one person at any one time. And we still haven't met such a person, because such a person really doesn't exist. So I think that's it. There's like an emotional component, Dennis, which blocks the cognitive processing of how to connect the dots.
I don't think it's really emotional. I think it's a question of confidence. And I remind these people, we all can't be mugwumps.
Okay.
That's a term that was used by Teddy Roosevelt, where your face is on one side of the fence and your backside is on the other. You cannot be one of those fence people. So I remind these people, if you don't have enough confidence in you, then think of God, who has complete confidence in you and is waiting for you. So to say you yourself don't have enough confidence, but our maker, our creator, believes you have all the confidence. So why don't you have more confidence in yourself? If you know the difference between right and wrong, then the rest of the things should fall into place. So you should have enough confidence to either help other people with it, help yourself, and connect with God about it, because that's what we're here for.
Okay. Listen, I will say this, that lack, because it's hard for me, Dennis, well, I'll agree to disagree with you on this, is that when a person has a lack of self-confidence, ultimately, self-confidence cannot be disconnected from any sort of cognitive attitude, meaning the lack of confidence or proper self-confidence was the byproduct of something that precedes it. And I'm just saying from the perspective that I had is that there was some emotional package or some sort of cognitive package which preceded the outcome, which was either proper self-confidence or lack of self-confidence. So on that point, I'll agree to disagree on that. But it's a minor point. But we'll let those who have just heard what I said and what you have said look into their own do their own research into these matters.
Fine.
Okay. So what would you like to share with us, Dennis, today from the Neshra Goldel, the Great Eagle, Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides?
Well, I have two short paragraphs from the Guide for the Perplexed, starting on page 103 of the online version. And here's how it goes. If, however, you wish to take the words, quote, "and Moses shall draw near," unquote, to mean that he shall draw near a certain place in the mountain, whereupon the divine light shone, or in the words of the Bible, quote, "where the glory of the Lord abode," unquote. You may do so, provided you do not lose sight of the truth that there is no difference whether a person stand at the center of the earth or at the highest point of the ninth sphere. If this were possible, he is no further away from God in the one case or nearer to him in the other. Those who approach him will obtain a knowledge of him, while those who remain ignorant of him recede from him. In this approach towards or recession from God, there are numerous grades, one above the other, and I shall further elucidate in one of the subsequent chapters of this treatise, which constitutes the difference in our perception of God. The next paragraph that follows there starts off with, "In the passage, touch, Ga, in parentheses, the mountains, they shall smoke." That's a quote from Psalms 154:5. The verb, quote, "to touch," or "touch," is used as a figurative sense. Quote, "let the words touch them," unquote. So also the words, "touch him, touch thou him himself," quote, unquote, Job 2:5, have the same meaning as, quote, "bring thy infliction upon him," unquote. In a similar manner, this verb, in whatever form it may be employed, be interpreted in each place according to the context. For in some cases, it denotes contact of two material objects, in others, knowledge and comprehension of a thing, as if who now comprehends anything which he had not comprehended previously, had thereby approached a subject which has been distant from him. This point is of considerable importance.
Thank you, Dennis. And again, the first piece that you read from illustrates that there is this commonality that exists among all people, whether you're in some level of called depths, or what is known as the ninth sphere, which I guess he's talking about in the astrological sense, that where you are still, you're still at a certain distance from Creator, and whether a person is learned or unlearned in terms of awareness of the divine instructions embedded in the Torah, that there are also individual endeavors and accomplishments and gradations, but still, they cannot negate the commonality. And of course, this last piece you read as well is chock full of profundities, common sense, axiomatic teachings. And again, it's the type of actually material that is so sobering in its presentation and so uplifting in its spirit that I can only say that I would encourage anyone who's just heard this, that when we morph into the archive version of today's program, to review it and then review it again and maybe speak it out with someone else, and you can have a nice conversation with someone, of course, you know, probably preferably outside of your business working hours, because it could lead to a deep discussion and cause a slowdown in your productivity. With that being said,
John,
let's.
I would think that the first paragraph referred to, my interpretation, is that don't worry about the physical distance of anything. The distance doesn't mean anything when you get or try to approach the Almighty. The second part is, It's a good wish that everybody is touched, because if you're touched by the Almighty, you're infused. If you're infused, that only charge you up to go on and do better.
Well, I would just say, Dennis, commenting what you said about the second reading, that, you know, it's a two-way street. Again, constantly, as long as we're living upon the living earth, we're all being infused. What are we going to do with this infusion? It's not a therapy, it's just an infusion of the life force that we have with us. What are we going to do to diffuse it to other human beings and realize, just like as one candle can light many other candles, its own light and warmth and brightness will not be diminished. It's actually testifying to the strength of its brightness, the strength of its warmth, the strength of its light that it can be shared with others. So, Blessed, I'm going to share something very tersely now from Rambam, from the Mishnah Torah, chapter 1, law 4, from the laws of the foundation of the Torah. Last week we talked about the idea that if Creator, heaven forbid, didn't exist, nothing else could exist. And this sets us up for today's teaching. This is implied by the prophet's statement. Who's the prophet in this case? Jeremiah, chapter 10, verse 10, where it's written, "And God, your Lord, is true." And Rambam elucidates, this implies, and literally means as well, paradoxically, Creator alone is true, and no other entity possesses truth that compares to his truth. This is what is meant, as Rambam continues, in the Torah statement, in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4, verse 35, quote, "There is nothing else aside from him," meaning aside from him, there is no true existence like him. With that being said, the Lubavitcher Rebbe as well, in his volume 24 of Lakutia Sichos, there is also a deeper dimension to the Rambam statement that we just read, that when a human being lives according to the Torah, he or she, which again we understand to mean divine instruction, but so when a human being lives according to the Torah, he or she establishes a unity with God, and that's the other part of the two-way street, that allows his or her existence to take on a truth and a meaning that is comparable to that of God himself. Now, let's be very careful, Blessed Souls. We're not promoting the idea if you live a exemplary Torah lifestyle, you are a God being. You know, we had enough of that from the history of Rome and the ancient Greek gods, meaning you are taking on godly qualities, and those godly qualities are some way and somehow self-perceivable, but hopefully more than self-perceivable, because we don't want to promote self-delusional thinking, that it, when you emulate a godly attribute of kindness or mercy and even justice when needed, that you are emanating out to other people, not just that you are the human source of that kindness, justice, or mercy, but that obviously you must be infused with a life force, that you're diffusing some of that life force back into the creation, that others can benefit from what you've been infused with in order that you diffuse it out into wherever you live. And even it might seem a minute amount of diffusion, well, you know, are we really going to, when a person has run, say, like a couple of miles in blistering heat, you know, heated weather, and the humidity is extremely intense, are we going to ask them what tasted better, the first drop or the 95th drop? No, it was every drop that was part of the restrengthening of that body, which is, tired and thirsty and longing to replace the waters which have been burnt out by the endeavor of running a certain amount of road space wherever he or she ran. Dennis?
The word truth is intriguing because it's used so frequently in Scripture. I think we have to sort of amend it a bit for the common world today, and that is you got to put the word absolute in front of truth when you talk about Scripture, because they're talking about the purity of everything, and the purity can only come from our Creator. So therefore, God does not lie. We say it, but we really mean the opposite, is that he's pure truth, absolute truth. This is something that we humans try to attain, but we can never reach it. Why? Because we are imperfect, and that's our goal. But we don't stop our goal knowing that we're imperfect because we want to say how near or close we can get. That is what we're expected to do and how we should behave. So it isn't a half-truth, a near-truth, a little white lie. Those are things that are rationalizations from a human viewpoint. When the Scripture talks about the truth, they're talking about the pure, absolute, unadulterated truth. And there is only one source for that, because he, our Creator, does not make mistakes. He doesn't tell lies. He's pure. And that's something that we try to attain because we're looking that we will eventually end up in heaven if we try to be as good as we can be. So the word truth here has a lot more meaning than just the word. It incorporates everything about our Creator.
Beautiful, Dennis. And now we're going to move into the portion of the program. We'll be elaborating on a teaching by Rabbi Nachman, the founder of Breslov Chassidus. And last week we mentioned briefly that song, Rabbi Nachman asserted that how judgment is mitigated, softened through song. And this is a teaching which is outsourced from the Holy Zohar. Also, it has a source in Psalms 106, verses 44 and 45, where it says, "And he saw that they were in distress when he heard their song. Then he remembered his covenant for them, and his abundant loving kindness relented." So, one of the things, blessed soul, is that, again, where people sometimes experience intense cognitive dissonance is where we take a teaching like this, which for some they'll accept it and some who won't, and some will be okay, sounds interesting, but Torah consciousness is not necessarily going to fit into a comfortable little linear package of cognitive facts for you, blessed souls. It encourages you to expand your mind, to also get into a type of exponential type of quantum physics type of thinking process, because the next point that Rabbi Nachman wants us to be aware of is that we have to cross-reference to a subject matter, which is actually something we'll be hopefully covering in the next couple months, maybe a little before Rosh Hashanah or after Rosh Hashanah, the idea of the rainbow, which appeared in the book of Genesis as described in chapter 6, verse 17. No, I think before, probably in the next 2 months, we'll probably cover it, hopefully. In chapter 6, verse 17, God said to Noah, "Behold, the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh is upon the earth." And that was alluding to the fact that the Most High placed a rainbow. Actually, excuse me. Let me correct myself. It's actually in chapter. So I was looking at the English. I should have looked in the Hebrew.
Let me just see it. Please bear with me. So that's part of the process. Okay, it's chapter 6, verse 16. I'm sorry. And I did read from the right verse, but I was also looking down at chapter 6, verse 17 in the English. So again, in chapter 6, verse 16, the rainbow is a recollection of a covenant that the Creator has made with us. Now, Rabbi Nachman wants us to understand that this rainbow, also known as the Keshet, in the Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew, is in fact the Shekhinah, the divine presence. And there were three primary colors, although it is classically associated with seven colors. This is not a contradiction. The three colors that Rabbi Nachman wants us to focus on, according to the teaching of the Zohar, are the colors of yellow, red, and silver blue. And each color is representative of a certain type of divine attribute, which three human beings who walk the face of the earth, each one of them a B'nai Noach, even though people also associate them with the Israelites, we're talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Israel. Abraham, his service in this world was allegorized as to correspond to the color of yellow in the rainbow, because he was considered to be a chariot of kindness. Yitzhak or Isaac, whose spiritual and physical endeavors in this world are allegorized to connect to the color red. And Yaakov Yisrael, he is allegorized that his service, which was one of the spiritual conduit of Tiferes, of beauty, was silverly blue. Now, Rabbi Nachman wants us to know that this type of presentation of the rainbow is showing that embedded within the creation, according to the Zohar, that the rainbow was created to protect the world. And the allegory given to help us understand why, when the rainbow appears, it was an expression, as we read before in chapter 6, verse 17, chapter 9, verse 17, to say that the rainbow, according to the Zohar, Rabbi Yossi says, the rainbow was created to protect the world. It is like a king who, every time he gets angry at his son and wants to punish him, the queen appears in her radiant garments. When the king sees her, his anger at his son disappears, and he rejoices in the queen, as is written. And again, if I said chapter 6, verse 16, or chapter 6, verse 17, I apologize, but I'm trying to immerse myself so to the point where I might have made a mistake in terms of the chapter. I think anyway, it was chapter 9, verse 16 that talks about the rainbow. And going back to this teaching from the Zohar, I'm sorry, it's a little choppy in my presentation, please forgive me. And he rejoices in the queen, as is written in Genesis 9, 16, I will see her and remember the everlasting covenant. Thus, the rainbow only appears in the world as radiant garments of the queen, which is an allegorization of the Shekhinah, which has a feminine sound to it at the end of the word, in the suffix of the word. Now, when there is a righteous person in the world, then in fact, the tzaddik himself is connected to a covenant protecting the world. But there is no righteous person in the world, consummate righteous human being living on this physical earth, the rainbow appears and the world continues to exist because of the rainbow. Now, everything in the world, blessed souls, corresponds to divine conduits. This is true of all the most basic elements of creation, which we talked about before: fire, wind, water, and earth, to the loftiest of God's holy names. And I think at this point, because I did chew off a bit and I was a little bit too choppy, I apologize. I'll have to prepare better for next week, hopefully, the next presentation of this series of programs, that we'll see that the rainbow, which offers protection, has in itself a configuration according to measurements of divine symmetry, which can soften the blow when, unfortunately, the actions of human beings are generating accusations from the heavenly court. And one of the most feared and misunderstood elements of the creation, the Satan, the Satan, is given the opportunity to make heavenly accusations against the children of men to cause what we call an imbalance, which can manifest into wars and, on a personal level, terrible behaviors which undermine the fabric of society on the most personal and general level. So we have a reassurance, blessed souls, that this creation is meant to have a protective force within it, but people hopefully will want to learn more about it. Dennis?
Yes, Don. When scripture was written, it didn't know the technology associated with rainbows. Since then, science has found out that there's a conical lens in our eyes, that depending on when we see certain things, we're looking at a rainbow. How this occurs, I don't know. How the conical lens got in our eyes, I don't know. But I have faith and belief, and I don't disagree with anything you've already said about it. But to me personally, it's a reminder that there is a greater power, and he controls everything, because it's not what we always see is there. So is there such a thing as a real rainbow, or is it something of an illusion with our lenses and our eyes? Either way, it was planted there for a purpose, and that purpose may be in the explanation you gave. It may not be, but it's something to consider, that if God went out of his way to show us that rainbows can appear, then should we always believe what we see? Or is that part of our imperfect imagination causing something to give us pause for thought? So I'll leave it at that, because I don't want to dispute or conclude anything, because this is a personal thing. We try to get other people, when we see a rainbow, to look at it and say, oh, yeah, I agree with you. In a lot of cases, they don't, because I don't see it, they say. But there are some people who agree and say, oh, yeah, I see that rainbow. So it's something we can envision, but we don't know if it's mythical or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just say, Dennis, on the most simple level of scriptural understanding, because there are literalists, and to the point where these literals exclude any other type of dimension of biblical scripture understanding, that in fact the rainbow is a physical entity. But where I would agree is that it doesn't mean that we're going to perceive it with all of its pristine profundity. And in fact, we might create a delusionary presentation of what this rainbow is. But personally, as a student of Torah, I am relying on the knowledge and whatever is capable to be within human purity of the teachings of Rabbi Nachman and those who came before him, most notably Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is the author of the Zohar. So I just want to share that point. With that being said, we're going to turn to some Chabad Hasidus, because we're winding down to like the last 12 minutes of the show. And again, when things get manifested, let's say via the word of a fleshly king, which for most people is a very remote idea, which they only learned about, you know, superficially in high school or watching movies, which are even more presentations of not really what a king is, except what the Hollywood ideal is, that the word of a king, when it travels out, can have an effect on his or, well, we're talking about a king. Let's say a queen's word as well. The king or the queen's word, if there is no king, like there's no king of England right now, the word of the ruler can have an effect on the country because of the fact that people respect the word, and because this person who is considered to be the monarch, king or queen, has been placed on an uplifted and exalted quality or stature within his or her society, where they have dominion over their subjects. So the Rebbe Rishab, the fifth Lubavitch Rebbe, as we pluck inspirations from his tree of life, the Kuntres Eitz Chaim, wants us to understand this parallels or some sort of reflection of the spiritual realms, because as we assert, if we are literalists in terms of understanding the book of Genesis, who created the world? Well, it says that the Creator spoke and various types of physical entities manifested. Therefore, we understand that the King's speech, the King of all kings, ruler of the universe, his speech had an effect. At the same time, too, there is a level of Creator which is way beyond anything which is identified to us in the Torah, in the Bible, Scripture, as He spoke and things came into being, whether it be the waters and the luminaries and the fish and the human beings and the crawling creatures and those fish in the sea. This speech is associated with a power which is divine, but yet, so to speak, congealed into the revelation of the divine experience of speech. So, since a name, or I should say a word, consists of letters, if those letters are transmitters of this energy of speech, they themselves have a tremendous significance because of the fact that they are speech or letters have been used as a conduit for human beings to understand this is the way things took place. Now, there is a verse as well in the book of Psalms, chapter 148, verse 13, where it says, His name is exalted alone, meaning the Creator's name, which is associated with also the fact that, or the names, there are various names for the Creator because He has infinite attributes, and every name in the Torah which is associated with the Creator is a source or a testimony, He's the source of certain types of attributes, that the name is exalted alone, His name. But again, we cannot disassociate His name from the fact that He decided to reveal to us His plan within creation via the blessed divine entity of speech. And as well, that is only His glory which is upon the heavens and the earth. And that's quoting from, I should say, where it says upon the heaven and earth, not His glory, but the expression upon the heaven and earth is from chapter 1, verse 3 from the book of Genesis. With this being said as well, that creation which was revealed through speech, which is tangible, because the Torah says the Creator spoke and things came into being, and it came from the name of Creator, which is exalted among all, yet at the same time too, you might say it's paradoxically occurring, that everything that we're talking about as an affirmation of manifestation, we suggest, as the Rebbe Rishab asserted, that this manifestation of something was still outsourced from a place in creation called Ein, or nothingness, divine nothingness, meaning it's only a ray, a mere shimmering of where that mere ray came from, meaning the energy, the divine light, vitality, potentialities within creation, although it seems to be quite potent because, in fact, we are living within the creation, is merely a shimmering of who the Creator is. Because, again, we cannot positively identify the Creator of what He is. We can only positively attribute attributes to the Creator by saying He is not this or He is not that. If we want to put that in the context of positively attributing, giving Him attributes. So, with that being said, so we're placing a lot of exponential type of cognitive scenarios for you to contemplate upon. Again, I'm not expecting anyone, especially someone who's heard this type of teaching for the first time in their life, to come to any conclusions, but rather, if it stimulates your curiosity to the point where you feel that it's worth your while to immerse yourself in such types of realms of awareness, it should be with the intention of generating a greater love and fear and respect for the Creator and a greater sense of wanting to diffuse positive consciousness, life-affirming consciousness to other human beings, well, I welcome you to come aboard and to learn more about these teachings. Dennis?
Yes, Don. When you started this speech on kings, it immediately hit me. You were really talking about a Hebrew word or a Hebrew concept called Elohim. And I think people have to understand the concept here when we use the word king, because the king of everything is our creator. There are no substitutes. But to put up a human as a king, that's just another human. So that human has to eat and do what all the other humans do. So what makes them any different is that they are trying to group people together to follow a certain way of living. So that doesn't mean it's good, bad, or indifferent, and it doesn't elevate them. It just means they're a leader among humans, but they are included. So unless, and I guess it's going to be another program where we get into the concept of Elohim, because that's where it originated from, and we must understand what the meaning of king is among humans and above humans.
Okay, very good. I just want to mention, I will not disagree with what you're saying, but I also will, to add to that paradigm that you, or that framework that you've just presented to us verbally, Dennis, is that the idea of king relates to any attribute or any entity in the world, whether it be human or mineral or air or... But that something has to be explained, because we're talking about it as a conduit. So here, the king of the universe spoke out with that attribute associated with judgment and measurement, limitation, and multiplicity, the name of Elohim, but it also relates to also different names of the creator. We're going to end up, Bustos, we only got about 4 minutes to go, but we're going to extend a little bit, maybe 5 minutes past our normal conclusionary presentations. And... this, we're calling from the book Torah for Gentiles, Messianic Implications of the B'nai Noah Laws, from Ms. Elishever Bar, because it happened to me today that how I misinterpreted the verse. And this is something to humble us and also to strengthen us. When we, you know, some people, when they get humble, they take it as an insult and it's a threat to their being. Actually, being humbled, as I was, and admitting to my mistake, is part of the process of properly accessing teachings which are way beyond human intellect, but yet paradoxically are configured that we should upgrade and elevate at some level, each person according to their own blessings, our human intellect. So this is what Ms. Barr wants us to be aware of, that misinterpretations are inherent to the reader's own frame of mind. The Midrash tells us that when Moses was writing the creation of each day, and he reached the verse, quote-unquote, and God said, let us make men in our own image and likeness, which, of course, you know, blessed souls, I love to promote, whenever I get a chance to promote that idea, that we all have a divine image. Moses, according to the Midrash, raised a question, quote-unquote. This is a conversation which transpired, according to the Midrash, between Moses and the Creator, because, of course, he was a prophet. If God spoke to him, he could speak back. And we understood that he actually spoke to him, because there's testimony from the five books of Moses when God actually spoke directly to the Creator. So I think it's a little naive of anyone to think that only when you read when Moses spoke to the Creator in the written scripture, it's naive to think he didn't speak to him according to the oral tradition as well. So, quote-unquote, Master of all, why do you give pretext to the heretics by using the plural form, as it said, let us make man? So God said to him, right, anyone who wants to make an error may do so. And that's quoting from the Bereshit Rabbah, chapter 8, teaching 8. Either because the one who wants to distort the meaning will do so, whatever is written, or in the words of Rav Sadia Gaon, because the Torah was not written for people who are acting, who have a foolish, I mean, the translation is stupid. I hate to use the word stupid, but I think that, you know, we are stupefying ourselves if we think that, you know, we cannot learn this stuff, this material, this type of consciousness, and not expect along the way that we'll make some mistakes, and we just correct ourselves. It's a matter of humility. So Ms. Barr concludes at this section, juncture of the book, as I will, we will sometimes refer to contrary views, not in order to create polemics, but for the sake of clarification. Dennis?
Yes, the clarification is very important, because in whose eyes is the clarification? And right, we have to keep it in perspective. And that perspective is, what, again, what is your position? Where do you fit in the spectrum of ideas? Are you thinking that you're a singular human, or do you realize that we have to mix and match our human world with our spiritual world. We cannot forget that.
True. So, Dennis, as we now come to our conclusion of today's program, again, thank you. I think it was, again, another vibrant, energetic, organic conversation. Is there something you'd like to boil down to something which is of your wisdom, which is implementable right now for any person who is listening to our live broadcast or eventually hear our archive version?
Well, yes, I'd like to plagiarize an old Yiddish proverb, and that is, surround yourself with mental midgets, and you will be a mental giant.
I never heard that one. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Where'd you hear that one?
Hear it? No, I read it in Jewish World Review this morning.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I love it. So, we're going to end off that. Oh, nice. I can't wait to share that with the people at work today. Okay. With that being said, we're going to end today's program with our friend David Dohm, who will help us get back home to help us realize that Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Let's all start to scrimmage with our divine image and to realize it is the nature, I should say that we have got to do good. Well, that's Dan Gutman's mandate to, not because it's mine, because it's the Torah mandate, because the Creator, who is a Teva Tov Lehetiv, the nature of the good to do good, has hardwired us to configure to, in fact, his plan for the creation and made this manifest in a way that Dar Chinom, in a pleasant way, Dar Chishom, in a peaceful way, Bahav Echad, with one love, Goral Echad, one destiny kolano for all of us, Laham Shich, to be continued, Bezal Hashem Yisbreak, to be continued with the help of the Most High Creator. And this is David Dohm's Travis song to help us get to that next experience in our lives, hopefully, in a way that we can say, thank God I've got to this point in time. Take care.
The banner of my life becomes unfurled. as I take my step to the glorious light. No longer caught will I be between two worlds, just a man and a prayer. Pray the Lord will take me there, yeah, to follow the yearning of my soul, returning with a heart that's full.